applause to Katana. Yes, thank you. Glad that I can be here and that you've all come. About my talk on social engineering, everything that you always wanted to know about social engineering but never had the time to ask. About me, who I am, what I do, you know me as Katana, as a speaker, and just one click, please. In real life, my name is Oliver Reitmeier. I am a psychologist, so one of these psychologists that sometimes sneak into the Congress. I'm a social engineer, and at the moment I'm a scientific assistant and PhD student at the University of Hanover in the subject of usable security and privacy. I like nerd things, social engineering, research, history, data, and privacy. And that's it about me. I would like to start this talk with a story. Here is what people think of as a grandfather, and this is about my grandfather, who was standing in his kitchen at one point and took a call. On the other side, there was a crying girl, apparently, crying loud, "It's so terrible, please help me, my ma, it's all too bad." And he wanted to know, who is this? Well, your grandchild. Well, who? Is it Anna or Jenny? Yes, it's Jenny. Mama has had such a terrible accident, it was quite confusing. I'll hand you over to the police person. Okay, and then there was a male voice saying, yes, this is inspectors, this and that. And Jenny's mother had a horrible accident with a cyclist who has sadly died. So you will now have to clarify this. In the meantime, my grandmother joined and heard that there was a crying girl. And who's this? She asked, this is Jenny, the grandfather said. So she took over, heard the girl crying, and the police person was talking to her too. We have to take care, have to arrest your daughter. And we could release her on bail if necessary. I don't know if her daughter would be okay with that. And the grandmother thought, well, said, okay, what's the price? Well, 70,000 euro. The voice said, and my grandmother was completely flummoxed and said, I don't think I have that much money. And then the police person was helpful. They said, well, if you maybe have any gold chains at home or any expensive watches, then maybe we can find a solution. And my grandmother then kind of was suspicious and said, well, I'll go to the police. And that was the point where the talk suddenly was ended. So many of you know this, that is the so-called grandchildren trick, social engineering in its purest form. And what I've just told you contains about everything that I wanted to talk about. It's a story, haha. It contains social engineering. Well, realize how it works. It makes clear how it works, and it shows measures as well. So I want to shine a light on what you can do. Today, we will work on a slightly, rather scientific basis. I have looked through various sources, and if you work scientifically, you do want to start with a definition. If you ask what a typical social engineering does, then you might come up with something like this. Strange, this is a male building something. This is about the definition of engineer. If you ask the practical people who really do social engineering, then they might say any act that influences a person to take an action that may or may not be in their best interest. So every action that gets people to do something, that's, I think, a very nice definition, and science is always focusing on this kind of security aspect. Here we have a definition. Mouton et al. Defines it like this. Social engineering is focused on the exploitation of a human in order to gain unauthorized access to information. So exploitation of a human to gain information that you should not actually have. Two varieties, I prefer the first one, and I think it gets more clear if you imagine who does this actually, who engages in social engineering. Various actors exist, and I've kind of shown you a range in security that you have the black hats, the gray hats and the white hats. And among the black hats, clearly you have the criminals. These are the grandchild tricksters. There are secret services, pretty normal for them to do this. This is their job. And on the white hat side, we have red teamers, these professionals that do it for the good, that are hired to be an opponent, to uncover weaknesses. And they have lay people. And they can sometimes be in the gray hat area as well, if intended or not. You don't know. You may now think, why didn't you mention hackers? Well, I have put hackers in every slot because I think this word should be liberated from its negative sense. Hacker is a neutral term. It doesn't have to have anything to do with criminality. And that's why I have them in all the three categories. And I forgot lay people. Why are they showing up here? Well, these are the largest group among the social engineers. And I will guarantee you, all of you have been or even are social engineers. Children, for example. Children cry on purpose to get what they want. Social engineering, emotional manipulation. Parents, they manipulate children. If you do your homework now, I'll give you one extra hour of PC time, computer time. Salespeople, this shoe will only be here for one more month, and then it will be taken off the market. If you don't buy it now, it won't be there anymore. Social engineering. And politicians, well, they promise anything in the world to get elected, so they are professional social engineers, but in a slightly different way. Of course, if you want to talk about something, you have to think of its history as well, to understand where it comes from.
And it's a very long story if we look at the history of social engineering. Actually, we know who or what the very first case of social engineering was. We know that because there's a source that is about 3,000 years old, and that says that the first social engineer from that source was a black hat. And many of you might think, interesting, that might have been a human, but no, actually it was an animal. That snake that has cursed us all to not live in paradise anymore. No, that's a joke. No, that's the Bible. You don't actually have to take it all literally. But there is some things we know that might be more sure about, that they're actually true. And if you go back 5,000 years, there are some sources where we can actually say that they might be a little more, that we can take more serious, and that may be true. The first case we have is ancient Egypt. We know that they had a spionage network. And because they had colonies, they had to gather information what happens in those colonies. Who knows this mask right here? It's connected to Greece, to Ilias. And what we also know is that between different city-states in ancient Greek, they sent people all across the cities to gather information on what happens politically, and they had to gather information and they had to use different kinds of technology like cryptography, going further to ancient Rome. they had an organization called Atari. They were a mix between Stasi and foreign country secret services, secret agencies. And they got information from all the different peoples and organizations they subjected. And that didn't come well across to all the people they subjected and tortured. And if you go back in time, if you go forward in time, and this is the people who got sent to the Mongol Empire by the Pope. They were sent to give gifts and to gather information about troop strength, and they also used social engineering for that. And finally, or almost finally, we have Francis Nottingham, who was a British spymaster, the first one to carry that name actually, who built up an organization to get people to give him information about from the Vatican and from England. And the highlight from all of this, I think, is the history of William Chaloner versus Isaac Newton. What many people don't know is
in England, das ist die Münzprägebehörde. Zu dieser Zeit wurden geschätzt ungefähr 10% der englischen Münzen gefälscht.
About 10% of English coins back then were actually forged. He faked English coins and got people to work for him.
And
when they were about to betray him, he told them, "No, if you want to betray me,
wenn ihr die hochhops nehmt und nicht mich."
You can betray different people, and you can betray them.
Well, and eventually they were hanged anyway after a few years. And now I think the more modern history of social engineering is more interesting to me. It starts around 1850, because by then more people were able to read and write, and stories were written down more as well. So the first example that should be noteworthy is William Thompson, the worst social engineer of all time, and he was the person who formed the word con man, because he walked up to people and say, "Well, give me your watch, please, or give me these £1,000. He did that this thousands of times. He succeeded 5 times and became rich that way. So that's why he's called the confidence man. He just had the confidence to talk to people in this way. So he formed this term. But interesting also is that there were women too. Adele Spitzeder, a woman from Munich. She was the first person who started a functioning Ponzi scheme or pyramid scheme. She founded a bank and paid the investors with the money of the new investors, and I think she had a 4 million revenue. And she just told them that she had a great system, a sales tactic, and she was never severely punished, so she got by quite well. Second woman, Martha Hari. Most of you will know her, I suppose. She was a spy who worked for the Germans around the First World War and collected information from Paris and the Netherlands for her, and is also quite known for what she did, and that was pure social engineering. This is one of my favorite stories. Viktor Lustig, that really is his name, because Lustig is German for funny. He was an Austrian who posed as an earl and went into high society. And what he did was he went to 6 scrap dealers and said, "I'm from Paris, and this Eiffel Tower that you know, it's getting old. We want to build it again. We rebuild it. So we're looking for scrap dealers buying all that metal from us." And by the by, I am a civil servant. You know how little civil servants earn. So you are all here. I don't know whom I should give this to. There are six competitors here. So he was actually paid a considerable bribe and the price for the Eiffel Tower, by which time this guy very quickly disappeared from Paris. And that's what made him turn him into quite a legend. But, sorry, this was then topped, because this person here, well, we don't have any sources what he looked like. This was an Indian called Natwalal. This person died in 2001, but he was famous. He sold the Taj Mahal several times to various people, the Indian Parliament, to people, including parliamentarians, members of parliament. Imagine that. And other government buildings. Seven times he escaped from prison, and once as a wheelchair user. I don't know. I don't know how, but he managed it. So he is kind of the king when it comes to trickery. And we have someone here who's quite well linked to German history. This is Markus Wolf, the head of the intelligence agencies in East Germany, and this was one of the best services that ever existed. They were unbeaten in their field, and that partly because Markus Wolf used the Romeo method. He hired people, mostly men, to approach secretaries of influential people and succeeded these to hand over information to the agents. That was quite successful, and if you can believe certain sources, there's a lot still to be clarified or unearthed. So he was quite successful, it seems. And if we talk about social engineering, this man should be forgotten. This is Kevin Mitnick, probably well known in security circles. I don't think he's the social engineer that invented all these modern methods, but he made them famous. He did things like SIM swapping, brought that to the fore. He did social engineering on the phone and reported about it and became quite well known with his books. And these are quite interesting to read. So if you have any interest, maybe you can try those. Okay, that's it for history. What is it like today?
There's the definition by Janssen and Solms. I find it quite nice. Phishing electronic deceives a user to confirm some action subsequently divulging sensitive information. So we do it electronically, that's important, so we get them to do what we want. That works by different vectors. Email phishing, everybody knows. There's also phishing via phone, when people are being called. It's via messaging, DHL, DPD messaging. You might have received some of those messages. And by now there's also deepfakes, but they're still very irrelevant because they're very rare, which is why I ignore them and don't mention them right now. But there's also still and social engineering, which works in person. Intelligence for industry, secret service operations, law enforcement, and also thievery. The difficulty ranges from email, which is very easy, all the way to in person, which is quite difficult. There is about 3 billion phishing emails, which is quite a lot. It gets really interesting when you look at the return on invest. It's not so easy because email is email is not so easy, but if someone clicks on it, you might get a good return on invest. But it's the same with. So now we know where we are. What I also promised is that I look at the effects. And there I will look at the I will present three models from psychology. There is two systems which I find to be too simple, so which is why I won't present them today. And there's also the four ears model, which I'm going to present quickly, which describes misunderstandings in communication. Every message has four layers. Appell, content, and I want to give you an example with a phishing email. And a social engineer who writes such a phishing email writes it in a way in which the receiver is supposed to be, get it. So, right here, this is pretty neutral on a content basis.
Die Beziehungsebene steht hier unten in diesem kleinen Logo. Wir kennen uns.
So, on the first level, the subject area is, here's a new file for you, self-disclosure, it's me, a bot. Relationship level is, I'm a friendly guy, we know each other, and appeal is, log in and check it out. This is how it works, if you do it right. The second model I'm going to talk about is cognitive dissonance. Many of you have heard about this. It's a very old concept since the 1950s. In 1962, the paper that I'm quoting was published. So cognitive dissonance is about within the same person when there are two events that are attractive but in conflict with each other. So A and A bar. So I like poker, I like to be in a casino, but I don't want to lose money. So these are two events that are positive but in conflict with each other. And then there are some moderators that decide whether you decide for one or the other. And you always need freedom of choice, of course. I have the choice to do either one or the other. There are no limiting factors that keep me from doing both, or taking both these paths. Question is, are there negative consequences? Of course. By playing poker, I can lose money, of course. If I don't play poker, I might not have such a nice evening. Who knows? And then there is this internal justification. Can I agree with myself to maybe lose a bit of money and have fun? Or do I do without the fun and keep my money and spend it for something else? And that means, and this way I will choose one or the other, and then of course I will then justify that somehow and make it into something correct. Social engineering, if there is just one event and we don't want it, then we create an artificial second event called B. We change the framework in a way that A loses, or we influence the person in some other way to make A lose and not like it anymore, change attitudes or something. An example, please clap if you know this building. Once, please, just once. If you don't know it, this is the cyber bunker. That was a bunker in which a few nerds locked themselves and did hosting for some people without looking what the websites contained. And of course, stories like that are not positive to the law enforcement, so they wanted to smoke these people out. And that was only possible via social engineering, because when these people were in the bunker, you couldn't get in. This bunker was closed. So what did they do? They had an informer in there, and this informer said, well, we could try. I will now tell these people that I have to leave the project, and I would like to have a kind of farewell party with the people in the bunker and have some fun before I have to go. And the problem was, they had a rule. At least someone must stay in the bunker. What did this person do? Exactly that. He changed the framework. Said, well, this is a one-off. We'll never meet again while being this young. I would really like to have that drink with you. Somehow it did work. The people went for that meal, and the security level was literally dust. One padlock, which the law enforcement people, well, they just used this to solve that problem. Cognitive dissonance, powerful stuff. There is another model that I like. It's quite complex, but it explains every kind of social engineering quite nicely, or it describes it. It's called the elaboration likelihood model. It looks complex, but it's actually quite simple. You have a source from which a message comes in. The message is a persuasive message. It arrives at the receiver, and now the question is, does the receiver have the motivation to do what the message wants? And does the person have the capability, not in the sense of skill, but do they have the opportunity to do this? Is there any external condition that keeps them from doing it? If both exists, motive and opportunity, then the message will always be processed centrally, which means the pro and con is going to be weighed up. Is it the right decision to make? And that then leads to a decision, say, to buy a car. That's a complex thing. I look at the Teslas. Do I want an electric car in the first place? If either motive or opportunity do not exist, then peripheral incentives might exist. So this is the other route. Emotions are important. Expression, visualization. And this then leads to a decision. And the interesting example is perfume ads. No one really listens to what they say about the perfume. You hear fantastic music, you see beautiful people, fantastic colors, and that's it. So that is the peripheral route. There are no arguments for perfume. Now, what does a social engineer do? In no way do we want to take the central route, because the people will start to think that's bad. They don't want to think way up whether you're honest or whether this is the right thing. They are supposed to do what I want them to do. So you change the framework and to make sure that it's the peripheral route that is taken, and then give them the incentive that works. And hopefully that will work. And what does framework condition actually mean? There are three things here. So there's pressure, perception, and focus. Pressure is very easy and very popular to use because that changes perception. There is emotional pressure, time pressure, which often leads to emotional pressure. That changes perceptions. You focus the people on what you want them to focus on. Magicians do this. They kind of wave something on the right hand, and in the left hand they do what they will have, what they will later place in the hat. And that's exactly the same thing. So if you want people to focus on specific things, you kind of let the important things slide by on the left, and that's what these social engineers do, at least the good ones. And that is exactly what I mean by framework condition. So this is what everyone does. Black hats, grey hats, white hats, this is what it's about.
If we know all that right now, that's good, because these models explain or describe. They don't tell us how to do it, and that's what we're going to talk about now. Bias, principles and techniques. And we're going to talk about these soon, but right now, how does social engineering actually, what effects does it have? There's wishes, habits, needs and much more. And those are all targets that I can attack and use for my own purposes. Who does it affect? With whom does it work? Social engineering, actually with every creature on Earth. There's different aspects that are distributed differently across different people. And that's why the effects of social engineering aren't always the same. You always have to think about who's in front of you. And that's why this is also a bit of gambling. People who are less adverse to risk tend to be better at this, because they can think about where this is going. But let's talk about the first thing that actually helps. And those are general tendencies and patterns of thinking that people just have. Where they come from, we don't actually know for sure. It's difficult to determine, but they can tell us how people will behave. And this experience can be morphed. And there's a couple of those. You can look at this in detail if you want.
Die sind empirisch erforscht.
They're empirically researched. I'll give you a few examples. The most popular bias is the confirmation bias. You look on purpose, target for information that does exactly what you want. Classical cognitive warp. I like the what I call the IKEA effect. I call it that because people things that people build on their own, they like to tend to like it a bit more. This trick is often used by Indian phone scammers. They call you and tell you you have a problem with your computer, and they let you click a lot of things. And after some time, Windows will tell you there's some problem with your computer, and then you'll get a message. So your computer just sucks. Your system is wrong. And then the user did it himself, themselves. And then the phone scammer says, yeah, you did this yourself. Just download a patch and we can solve your problem. So the framing effect is very important when it comes to this. Let's suppose we're a company and we want to sell the blue phone, which costs 250 euros. But we also produce the black phone, and there are some differences between the blue and the black phone, but actually the black phone costs 50 euros less, and it's also a good deal. So what do? But people will say, well, the blue phone only costs a little more. Well, I maybe go with the blue phone instead. So people will often think that the more costly option will actually be the better one, which isn't always the case. Which is the bias blind spot. Which is an empirically researched phenomenon, which says that people are always, other people are always more biased than you yourself. He who manages to abuse that is the king of social engineering. Because you can actually beat people who think they are resilient against biases, you can use that against them to trick them with their own bias resistance. And there's also the principles of social influence, which already exist since the 80s, which is the principle of you give me and I give you. And there's the principle of authority,
so there's reciprocity, authority, scarcity, there's trustworthiness and external consistency, a strong effect that you can use well. Consistency is external and the other is you want to appear like a stable person. You don't want to do one thing at one point and another thing at another. And something like 95% of customers love this product. They would buy this. So this is a social proof that something that works. And sympathy is the easiest thing in the world. I like you. If you tell me something, I will do it. Quite simple. There's a nice use of that, and that is the lowballing technique, a sales technique, that uses this kind of social binding, trustworthiness, and consistency. And so they sell a picture and then bill every stroke of the pen, the brush individually. And the first scientific description was published in 1979. So we have a salesperson and we have Bob. The salesperson tells Bob, look, this powerful fruit computer is only 1,000 euro. And Bob says, okay, cool, great, I'll take it. 1 hour later, the salesperson says, well, this is 32 gigabytes of RAM, 500 gigabytes hard disk, and with the adapter we'll make that 1,900. And Bob says, well, I said yes already, so on with it. That's lowballing. Because these RAM and hard disk and adapter things were extras. So we know the effect and we know the science behind it. Let's summarize. Social engineering works in your mind. Everything internal is it can be attacked because we're people, we're humans, and it doesn't go away. Even if you believe that you've overcome it, you again are under another kind of bias. And you might say, well, Katana, how about all this great knowledge about unconscious behavior that this friendly FBI guy has taught me?
Okay.
Let's talk about nonverbal behavior. In principle, I'll start with an example. You have this. This is power posing, a super hit in psychological literature. So this is if you stand up like this and do this for a certain while, it's supposed to give you more confidence and effect. Cool, right? People thought. Would be great if this would work, but there was a catastrophic failure that came about. It couldn't be proved, or very badly. There were no control groups, or no control positions. Meta-analysis led to a zero effect, so they backpedaled and said, well, okay, there is no physiological or behavior features, but maybe cognitive. And social engineering does work in the mind, right? So the practicals then looked at it and said, let's do this. Super important. Well, there are some basic problems. People say, well, you can read emotions from the face, can't you? Well, why not? Isn't the nonverbal important? Well, sure, you can. Yes, it exists. Paul Ekman found this. You can read emotions from facial expressions. That is quite undisputed, and you can see it here, can't you? If you read through this, you have wrath, disgust, pleasure, fright, sadness, surprise. Well, sadly, the body has developed things that are much more unambiguous. You have sounds, laughing, screams, body posture, we have crying, again we have tone of voice as in wrath, and we have sounds of surprise. That is all much more unambiguous. And Paul Ekman said this and said, hey, why can't we do the same thing for lying? Isn't there some way how we can watch, observe people lying subconsciously? So they thought, okay, let's do this. Huh? Classic. The problem was, there were many problems with these studies. Methodology, kind of bad, hard to replicate sometimes, sometimes no diversity in terms of age, sometimes a tautological design, and the facial action coding system that was developed from this is still much disputed. So all of this is kind of research. The basic idea is there is nonverbal communication that would mark deception, and practicals were then thinking, okay, great, if you can overcome this, this is a fantastic social engineering thing. So that's why many social engineers really praise this highly. It's part of the myth that nonverbal communication is part of the toolkit always. But the quality of the research often is, well, like a CSI Miami episode with a lab coat. You can ask me, scientists are often sued if they criticize other scientists, but highlights are bad statistical power, non-empirical sources quoted, and so on and so forth. And probably the error rates are quite high too, and the effects are quite small, which makes it bad too, makes it very problematic. So do we have a post-factual practice now because everyone's doing this or what? There is a systematic problem in the house, says the slide. Problem is, practitioners rely on scientists because they have to know what they're doing. But if they don't know so well what they're doing, and maybe find something that is not so safe, then it's problematic. They have problems then assessing these things. So I'm going to talk about the psychological background. There are some basics that I would like to explain. You will just have to believe me. Sorry, no sources here. So conscious and subconscious often are quite unrelated. If you ask the normal American on the street, how are you? He will say, I'm doing fine. Even if internally they might want to shoot themselves. So this is a habitualized lie. It's not like someone saying, I didn't rob that bank. No. You can never judge the subconscious from the conscious or vice versa. Second, the subconscious is often corrected consciously. If people ask you, will you help me with my house move? You may think, I don't want to, but then you will modify this and say, yeah, well, no problem. Because this is a friend. And that, by the way, is cognitive dissonance being solved. And there are some sublines. So, human behavior often comes from norms or laws, and they're not always sensible. People are susceptible to routines, which sometimes also are not rationally founded. The cultural surroundings determine norms and laws. In Japan, social engineering is quite different from here. And human behavior is often learned, which means that it can be unlearned as well. So all this kind of goes across nonverbal communication. We have, for example, Alice here and Bob. Alice wants to tell Bob regarding behavior that she likes him, but she's shy, doesn't want to say it directly, so she tries to give a sign. Alice has certain things, norms, empathy, stereotypes, expression, understanding regarding nonverbal communication or knowledge, and all this, through this filter, is a filter through which the thing that Alice wants to tell Bob will go. And there is another filter on Bob's side, and that's Bob's norms, empathy, stereotypes, expressions, understanding of nonverbal communication and knowledge. And, well, to be honest, he probably won't get the hint. It's never guaranteed that what you mean is actually going to arrive in this way if you do it non-verbally. Now, question is, can this be examined in a sensible way? I don't believe it can, but even if I'm wrong and it is possible, then I will doubt the ethics of that. And if you look at the meta-analysis, it does seem to be quite irrelevant. The effects are very, very small. So be very careful about this non-verbal crap. So measures, this is the important part.
What helps and what doesn't? Disclaimer, I am mostly referring to phishing right now, because science right now mainly focuses on phishing, and because phishing is the biggest social engineering problem we have right now. What's not that good? Point one, a phishing simulation. You all know that? But it's more of a game for CEOs, so the numbers go down. There's a few papers about that. It has lots of negative effects. Less trust by the employees and some hidden costs that cannot be seen up front. Pressure of time is also very bad. Bad psychological culture at the workplace, which is also not good for IT security. Sensitizing alone also doesn't help. And a bad behavior with emails that one receives, which one has learned, which also doesn't work. And the usual crap like pay attention for spelling and grammar is also not helping. But what actually helps? The basis of everything is education. Stay informed about phishing. There's information by various agencies. They show what's currently going on in the domain of phishing. Use very entropic passwords or even password generators and password managers. If possible, use passkeys and not actually passwords. Check links in emails, not only if you have the mail, but also if you, when you actually land on the web page. But also, maybe don't use the link in the email at all, but go to the website yourself and log in there yourself. For organizations, there's also some aspects. Measure knowledge about IT security for all your employees at the same time and also individually. There can be bad effects for people if you measure them too closely. We know that. Establish a good workplace culture for security. If you don't have a good organizational culture, if those things haven't been established yet. And please give some money to IT security.
Wie man so eine Organisationskultur entwickelt, auch mit Security.
How to develop such a culture is pictured in this graphic, where you can read about that. That was it from me. I'm done. You can find me on Mastodon. If you've got some questions, I'm open for that now.
Wow, das war ein Sprint.
Well, that was a sprint. A sprint through the history of social engineering.
Was es so alles mit sich bringt.
And what comes with that?
Okay.
Awesome, thank you. Okay. Do you have any questions? If you have any questions, please go to the microphones.
Wird euch geholfen werden.
And then you'll receive some help.
Hallo,
number one, you want to ask some questions? Hello, thank you for your talk. I have a question.
Intention, quasi,
you talked a lot about the negative intentions, but there's also some positive possibilities to use this. For example, if you nudge people into buying more fruit at the supermarket. Are there also some studies about that and some research? Yes, there is, but they're more in marketing psychology. They don't call it necessarily social engineering. They call it framing. They're very important, but yeah, they're more in the domain of marketing psychology. But yes, this study exists, but you have to search a little differently. Thank you. Now, microphone number two, please. Hello, thank you for your talk. You were a little bit fast for me, for my taste, just with the phishing simulations. What were those all about? It depends on what you look at. It might be the case that it doesn't have good effects on the employees. They might feel sort of tricked or betrayed by such research measures. And the results might also be not that helpful, perhaps, because you don't know who you actually need to school in the end. And if you say you measure people by just the facts that they know, there are much better ways to make them stronger. So this doesn't help very much. Okay, thank you.
Haben wir noch Fragen? Signalengel, haben wir da vielleicht was?
Ja. Do we have some questions by the Signal Angels?
Dann komme ich zu dir.
Wir haben unter anderem die Frage aus dem Internet.
Amongst others, we have the question from the Internet. What role will AI play in the domain of social engineering in the future?
Wie kann man sich dagegen wehren, vielleicht?
How to defend against this?
Was die Rolle angeht, ich habe ja schon mal.
When it comes to the role of AI of this, I think this will definitely increase, albeit slowly. It has to be done in IT systems that people have at home, because it cannot run in the cloud. When it comes to email filtering, it's not very effective because way too many emails still come through, so this doesn't help very much either. How long this will take to develop, I cannot say. Thank you. Microphone number three, please. Hello. Do you know what the replication crisis says about elaboration likelihood? Difficult to tell. It depends on what you test exactly. I did not look much at studies that looked at predictions about LLMs. it's very difficult, especially when it comes to replication. What it says exactly about the theory, I don't know. If you have something, please come back to me. I'd like to talk to you about that. Okay, and microphone number one, please. I think microphone number four was before me. You mentioned that the scammers have gotten better in spelling and grammar. I actually heard the opposite, that they consciously write worse and in less good style to look more authentic. Do you know anything about that? Is that true? I don't know anything about that. Might be true. It's a theory. We'd have to look at the data. I don't actually know what people think when they send phishing emails. Might be true. Might be an interesting poll. Microphone number one, please. The negative effect of group trainings. I would be interested in. I'm a trainer in arts. Can you tell me when exactly group trainings are not useful? Well, it depends on how big exactly the group is and what exactly the topic is. Well, if you're in the domain of sports, it depends. When it comes to the sharing of knowledge, it might be the case in a big group that individuals might not dare to ask questions. And even if people share something, they often just repeat what other people said already. So that's not very useful. And when it comes to gaining strength against in cybersecurity, it's more complicated. And phishing competence.
Any more questions? Well, you mentioned as an example politicians that do social engineering. There were no specific examples in the talk. Was this consciously holding back, or did you have instructive examples that you might want to look at? First question. Well, look at a debate in Parliament. That is the basic thing. Social engineering is about convincing people, and all these models that are talked about are models that should help convincing people of things. And of course, people use these politicians use these methods. So they use certain phrases, they structure their talks in a way that their arguments sound most sensible, even if they're not. All that is social engineering. It's nothing new. Okay, and then as a connected question, you mentioned this first system where people think critically about something. What are good ways of getting people towards doing that? Time is one factor, and that's the biggest. People need time. That is the problem. Even if, especially if it's complex problems, then you need time to actually look at them. And of course, this should not be beyond the horizons. So if you have something like hard malware reverse engineering and tell this to someone who doesn't do this professionally, then this person will not be able to do this, and then that will not have an effect. So you have to assess what the person might sensibly be able to do and whether they have enough time and space and whether they have the confidence to do that. Speaking of time, it's getting close. I can see two more questions that I would like to take. Right, I got that there are situations for social engineering that where we're simply exposed and other situations where we enter happily and voluntarily, such as C3 perhaps. And in the first half of my life, I was in a big machine of social engineering and conditioning via the school system, but also the security apparatus in Syria. And that is a very obvious obvious form of social engineering. In an interview, it was said that people arrested were told that school was quite similar to torturing to me. And I then went to school in Germany and saw something quite similar. So, if people don't openly say that I'm playing with your head right now, then that's still bad, and it's not quite different in Germany. And I would like to know whether schools and university should not be regarded as a critical apparatus for social engineering as well. Well, that is a very complex question. I don't think I managed to do this in this talk. We could have another conversation about this later on. Too long didn't read? No, but that has various reasons. Society, living together, is always a kind of engineering, right? Yes. Okay, the last question, number four, but briefly before that, if you exit the room, please take your trash with you and do not smoke in the building, okay? Number four. I wanted to ask, I've often seen on shampoo bottles that people write, this is now with the new fantastic formula and now you can attempt to read no bullshit. Is this the kind of bias, anti-bias thing? Well, it is an advertising slogan, of course, and how much people are thinking when they do these advertising slogans, I don't know. Well, they do much, much more and then arrive at something like that. All right, Signal Angel, one very final question. Last question from that internet, an interesting one. Is there any way to react to social engineering if you notice it at someone, at a person? Go away.
Okay.
I'll use that as a conclusion. Katana, that was fantastic. Thank you. Thank you also for listening to our...